Good morning. It's my pleasure to have with me two of the leading expounders of Maimonides' 13 principles in the world. Professor Kellner I introduced previously, so we will not do that again. To my left is Professor Mark Shapiro, who holds the Weinberg Chair in Judaic Studies at the University of Scranton. He's well known for his books, the first one about the three-day age between the yeshiva world and modern orthodoxy, the second one, The Limits of Orthodox Theology, which directly is discussing our present topic. His third book, a small monograph on Saul Lieberman, and he's about to publish a book on Maimonides and his interpreters. I would commend you in the first place to take a look at the sheet which was handed out. There are two sheets. One of them has a listing of the 13 principles. And to begin this session, we're going to read not only the 13 principles, but also Maimonides' remarkable statement which follows those principles as a prelude to our discussion this morning. So I'll just give everybody a moment to take a look at those. And we'll read them out together.
Pretty long.
That's all right. We'll do a little short job on it.
You'll note that the principles are basically laid down in certain sort of categories. The first five about God, that God exists as one, is incorporeal, is prior to the cosmos, and is the sole subject of worship. The next few having to do with prophecy and Torah, that there is such a notion of prophecy and that Mosaic prophecy is superior to all others, that the Torah is given from heaven, mina shamayim, and cannot be changed nor exchanged. The last four having to do with issues of providence and eschatology. Number 10, that God knows individuals, that the righteous will reward and evil punished, what's called in Hebrew, of course, hashgacha. The 12th principle, that there will be a coming of the Mashiach, and the 13th, that there will be Tchiyat HaMetim. As Professor Kellner talked about in the previous session, there was something absolutely revolutionary about this, but what is more remarkable than a listing of the principles is the consequences for noncompliance, which Maimonides talks about after he finishes presenting the principles, which are, of course, part of his Perush on the Mishnah on Perek Chelek, the last chapter of Tractate Sanhedrin. Maimonides writes the following. When all these foundations are perfectly understood and believed in by a person, he enters the community of Israel. One is obligated to love and pity him, to act towards him in all the ways in which the Creator has commanded that one should act towards his brother. It's double-sided. With love and fraternity. Even were he to commit every possible transgression because of lust, because of being overpowered by the evil inclination, he will be punished according to his rebelliousness, but he has a portion of the world to come. He is one of the Poshei Yisrael, the sinners of Israel. Right? So Maimonides is very clear that no matter what kind of sin and behavior you commit, there is still some kind of portion for you in Olam Haba. However, he goes on to say that if a person doubts any of these foundations, he leaves the community of Israel, denies the fundamentals called a sectarian, apikoros, one who cuts among the plantings, quoting a pasuk, one is required to hate him and destroy him. And about such a person it was said, do I not hate them, O Lord, who hate thee? Right? Singly remarkable text, because it seems to indicate that belief is the foundation for eternity and that there are no excuses. Ignorance is not an excuse. I didn't know that is not an excuse. Lack of education is not an excuse, etc. In modern terms, this seems very unfair, and I know that when I and other teachers teach this text, it's very troubling to our students. We wanted to bring these gentlemen here this morning to flesh out some of the issues. Let's begin historically. We know, and Professor Kellner alluded to it in his previous talk, that there is a hint of dogma, right? There's a hint of issues regarding belief in that Perek Chelek and Sanhedrin that Maimonides is commenting on, because the Mishnah there discusses, the first Mishnah, that there are three things that block you from entering Olam Haba, but both of you in your work have noted that there's something unprecedented in the formulation of this in the 12th century. Very suddenly, 3 becomes 13. What was stated negatively in the Mishnah is stated positively by the Rambam. What is prompting Maimonides to formulate these principles? In other words, why did he need to? Why does he feel compelled to write this? And, you know, Professor Kellner and I have talked about the fact that it might be an internal reaction to care rights, it might be an external reaction to Christianity, but something is going on here.
Me? Okay.
I think there are a lot of things going on here, and they fall under several headings. The first of them falls under something I talked about in my previous presentation, namely Maimonides' definition of human beings as rational animals. For him, a person becomes fully human when they know truth. We would think a person, in that context, a person becomes fully human when they exercise their mind, even if they arrive at wrong consequences. For Rambam, to be a truly rational animal, i.e. a fully completed human being, is to know the truth. Now the Mishnah starts by saying, "Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chelek l'olam haba." All Israelites have a share in the world to come. If having a share in the world to come depends upon knowing the truth, the Mishnah can't be true. It's an exaggeration at best. Unless we do, as I propose in one of my writings, I don't remember where, that Rambam interprets Israel to mean those people who understand the truth. Then all Israelites have a share in the world to come, but not all Jews are Israelites. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that Rambam wants to make the Mishnah true. In other words, he wants to teach in popular form enough philosophy such that any Jew who holds these 13 principles will actually know enough truth to share or merit a share in the world to come. A third thing that's going on here, I think, and this is very important, is the social circumstances. Rambam, I'm convinced, felt it was dangerous to allow for theological pluralism within Judaism. It's one thing that the Muslims could allow for themselves because they were very powerful. And they could have different schools of thought, and actually they could, by this time the Shiites and the Sunnis had more or less divided. They could afford that. He knew probably by hearsay of the tremendous doctrinal battles among Christians, and they figured they could also afford that, or he didn't care. But Jews couldn't afford that. And so I think that was the third reason. Jews, as a persecuted and harried minority in a very hostile world, could not afford a laissez-faire approach to theology, which I think is the way Chazal approached it. Don't ask, don't tell, that kind of thing. Rambam, I think, felt that in the situation in which he lived, the Jewish people couldn't afford that. And I think a lot of people today who feel the same way. The kind of people who, we talked about this a lot last night, the kind of people who put a ban on Rabbi Slifkin's books felt that they could not afford to allow for any kind of theological pluralism within their own communities. And so I think there's also that playing a role here.
Yeah, just to add, and Professor Kellner pointed out, the fact that the Rambam he's concerned and he wants to ensure that everyone has some level of immortality by exercising their intellect. But I would just pick up on something you said. You said it doesn't strike moderns as fair. And that's right. Because if you regard, and the Raivad had the same concern, if you regard the world to come as a reward, that is, God grants you a reward, then of course it's not fair. Someone doesn't know any better. And that's why the Raivad says that if you don't know a certain principle and it's not your fault, you still could be a righteous person. But the Rambam does not regard the world to come as a reward. In fact, the Meiri, in describing his view, calls it a tolda. It's just a result. It's a natural process. You expose your mind, you develop your intellect, and then when you die, the soul lives on. So it's not a question of fairness. People who haven't, it's a natural process. Rabbi, this is unpalatable. If you look in Rabbi Blech's book, With Perfect Faith, in the introduction, he tries to make this more palatable by saying that if you've never studied algebra, you can't move on to calculus. And it's not that it's not fair, it just doesn't go, and you can't go any further. Think back maybe when we were all young and they told us that when in the world to come, you sit and learn Torah all day, so who wants to go there? So it's not a question of fair, and I would dare say that according to the Maimonidean understanding, if you've never developed your intellect, understood the intelligibles, you have no interest in being up there anyway. So it's a different conception.
I guess I'm wondering, both of you cited, Professor Kellner cited in his book, lots of objections or just avoidance of the principles, and you also cited that Chazon Ish rejected the idea of, you know, culpability, right, that you, Shogeg is still a category for him, and that the Rambam rejected Shogeg as a category, rejected the idea that if you didn't know, that, you know, should
exculpate you. So obviously there were people who didn't agree with the Maimonidean take, right? But you pointed out that the disagreements were sort of in stasis for a long time, and it seems to us that these principles have taken on a kind of life of their own lately, sort of post-war Judaism. There's a lot of writing, a lot of talk now about 13 principles. I'm wondering if you can tell me why you think they've sort of had a new life in the modern world.
Why don't we divide this in half? I'll talk about up to the French Revolution, and Mark will talk about afterwards, okay?
Okay.
Or we can do it the other way, but
helpful.
Rambam promulgated his 13 principles in his commentary on the Mishnah. He reiterates them in different language in Hilchot Tshuva, Laws of Repentance. And I think an argument can be made that the Guide of the Perplexed is ultimately structured around the tripartite division that Eliot mentioned. When the Rambam died, discussion of the principles didn't even begin. There was no discussion of them. In the 200 or so years between his death, between his death in 1204 and the year 1391, which is like 200 years, almost something like that, close to it. I pretend to be an expert in the history of philosophy, not in arithmetic. In any event, for a very long period of time, we have no texts written by Jews which take these principles at all seriously. We have a lot of poems. Well, they obviously answered a felt need in the community, but none of the authors of commentaries, of She'elot and Tshuvot, of Responsa, of Talmudic works, they just ignored them. And I think the reason is that they fell out of the purview. The philosophers who came after Rambam felt these were too parochial. And the halachists thought they were too unprecedented. And they didn't know how to handle them. In 1391, a huge wave of anti-Jewish, what we would call today, in retrospectively, pogroms broke out in Iberia. And connected to that was a concerted effort to bring about the conversion of the Jews to Christianity. And we have, during this period, forced disputations, earlier and also many more later. We have in this period the development of a huge Christian anti-Jewish literature. Now, when a Christian attacks Judaism, a Christian will say, this is what we believe. What do you believe? And Christianity is certainly in the Middle Ages, a religion based upon a strict dogmatic base. So suddenly Jews were confronted with the need to respond to an attack put in dogmatic terms, in systematically theological terms. So they suddenly found ready to hand Rambam and his principles as a very effective tool. But the Jews who wrote in this fashion, there were like a dozen or so in the century, in the 15th century, not one of them accepted Rambam's principles as such. Every single one of them accepted the idea that Judaism has dogma. Every one of them implicitly interpreted the notion differently. This is going to appeal to only very few of you. Answers to questions, it's important to know what question is being asked in order to understand what's being said. This is Nechama Leibowitz's very famous way of interpreting Rashi. Rashi is always giving answers to understand what he's doing, to ask what question bothered him. So similarly, 9W is an answer. What's the question? Do you spell your name with a V, Mr. Wittgenstein? 9W! It's also apparently an exit off some highway near New York to Muncie, so Jews generally like that. In any event, What question was Rambam answering with his 13 principles of faith? I think the answer was, who is a Jew? Rav Chastai Kreskes wrote a book on systematic theology, and he was answering a different question. What beliefs must a person hold to make belief in revelation possible? Rabbi Yosef Albo, who wrote another book, was answering a different question. His question was, if you construe Judaism as a geometric science, what are its axioms? So even though they all agreed that they adopted Rambam's, to my mind, chidush, innovation that Judaism has dogmas, they didn't accept his understanding of what a dogma was, and they certainly didn't accept his list. All the people who wrote about these things in the 15th century provided different lists. Now, what happens in Christianity when somebody provides different lists of dogmas? After you get finished killing a lot of people, you have a new form of Christianity, right? You have a schism. What happened among the Jews when Rambam, Albo, Kreskas, Duran, Abravanel, Avram Shalom, and many other people whom you've never heard of, proposed different lists of dogmas? Now, from that we learn that they weren't really serious about it. If you believe that accepting a dogma is what the key to being a member of the Jewish people and having a share in the world to come, and yet you can have debates over this and propose different lists, it seems to me a pretty clear indication that this was a literary device and they weren't really serious in proposing these as dogmas. But there was a felt need, and that's why during the 15th century you have the great flowering of dogmatic literature in Judaism. What happened afterwards, Mark will tell you.
Just to frame it for you, Mark, somehow people have gotten serious about it. To use Menachem's words, there's criticism of the book you wrote, Limits of Orthodox Theology, and one of the criticisms came from a rav in Israel, Rav Zev Leff, who criticized your book and wrote that one who denies any of the 13 principles is outside the pale of the faith community of Torah Judaism. Those are his exact words. So partly what's curious to me is that I have a feeling that there's nobody in this room who's within the faith community of Judaism on some level, because I'm not sure there's anybody who doesn't have some doubt about one principle or another. But what strikes me in relation to what Professor Kellner was just saying is that if it was ignored or it was yawned at for a long time, it's not being yawned at now. How come?
I have a few comments, and then I'll get back to what Professor Kellner said. But since you raised the review, those who were here last night heard Professor Kellner make an interesting comment that a lot of people who write about theology don't really have a clue what they're writing about. And I mean that in all seriousness. The fact is that you don't just have to say this room. If you go into any Haredi yeshiva, most people there, almost everyone there, says the third paragraph of Shalom Aleichem. Most of them recite Slichot, which are without question in opposition to the Rambam's fifth principle. This idea that everyone accepts the fifth principle, there's been a huge debate on this. There are those who don't. The Briskers, for example, will not recite the third paragraph. It's a direct prayer to an angel. And they won't say the Machnisei Rachamim because it's in violation of the Rambam's principles. And many people have discussed this, and they've said that we don't accept all the Rambam's principles. And you can go to the YU website, you listen to Rabbi Willig, hardly a flaming liberal, and he must conclude in discussing this that at the end of the day he says, we really only accept 12 and a half principles. But then if I recall correctly, he says, but you know, we don't need to go out and spread it. What does that mean? Because it's a slogan. That's all it is. It's a slogan. It's like saying that he's a tzaddik. Jacob observed Taryag Mitzvot, or someone else observes. It means it's a shorthand for saying someone's in the community, someone's a believer. But if you actually look at the various principles, so much so that in debate over my book, people were forced to conclude, you see this online, that we accept 13 principles, but not the Rambam's 13 principles. We accept the 13 principles as they've been developed over time, and the community of Israel has determine that. So that's a pretty unique position. But there have been threats to Judaism, ideological threats within Judaism, so it became very important to determine dogma. And obviously there are certain basic dogmas which traditional Jews have to believe. I think it's interesting. Professor Kellner wondered why no one's discussing the 13 principles after the Rambam. I'll say that the Rambam never discussed the 13 principles. He wrote it in his first book, and he never comes back to it. The Mishnah Torah, Yesodei Torah, right at the beginning, what would you expect him to tell you the 13 principles? He doesn't. If you count it up, he has close to about 18, 19 principles. In the Guide for the Perplexed, he never mentions it. It's as if in his eyes, this was an early formulation. He began the commentary as a youth, early 20s, and he never comes back to it. If it was so important, he would stress it over and over again. This actually led no less a personality than Rav Shlomo Goren to conclude that the Rambam actually abandoned his system of 13 principles because he himself never comes back to it. It has a, what do we call it, nachleib in it. After his lifetime, it becomes important. There's not just the Yigdal, there's about 100 different poetic compositions. It became a shorthand. So why his shorthand of 13 and not Albo's or the others? Because I think 13, as we heard, is a good number and people like more rather than less. And let me finally say that it's not just other people. The Rambam himself, and this there can be no doubt, the Rambam himself, I'm not going to say he doesn't accept all the principles, but I will say he doesn't accept that all the principles are dogmas, that he doesn't believe that if you deny these principles, you are violating dogmas. Why not? Because in the Guide for the Perplexed himself, he tells us that you are not obligated dogmatically to believe in creation, ye'ex nihilo, yesh me'ayin. And yet in the principles, he says you are obligated. And that's not the only example. So when the Rambam himself tells you, although he says he believes in ex nihilo, he says it's not a dogma. So what do you do when you have the Rambam himself saying that what he says in the principles is not a dogma, and in the principles he says it is? I conclude, therefore, that there's an element of rhetorical power, of rhetoric, of political reasoning going on there in the principles. They don't reflect either his final opinion or ever his completely thought-out opinion. Anyone who says that the 13 principles were held as dogma by Maimonides is contradicting Maimonides' direct words in the Guide for the Perplexed.
Can I add a word to that? Two things, one short, one long. I like to try and come up with clever titles for my articles. And I once wrote an article, Could Maimonides Get into Rambam's Heaven? And it's basically filling out the ideas that Mark just stated. It's not very clear that Maimonides could have gotten into Rambam's Heaven. But I wanted to add a further point about the modern world. In the aftermath of the French Revolution, Jews, for the first time in their history, at least for the last 2,000 years, were in effect invited to participate in the world around them as full citizens, but as full citizens. You know the famous line of the delegate to the French National Assembly after the Revolution, to the Jew as Frenchman, everything, to the Jew as Jew, nothing. And that brought about a need for Jews to understand their identity in new ways. And suddenly, questions which had never been asked were beginning to be asked, among which was, is your Jewish identity a function of national identity? Is it cultural identity? Is it religious identity? Is Judaism a denomination like Lutheranism? Is it a national identity like being Danish? These are the questions with which every single person in this room wrestles every morning before brushing her teeth or his teeth. We live in a world in which Jewish identity has become fractured. I think that's partially the reason why the Karim play such an important role. When it's no longer intuitively clear who Jews are, or what it means to be a Jew, or what it means to be a good Jew, this is a very convenient hook on which to hang answers to that question. And therefore, I think it was that in our world, it became much more important than it was before the wave of assimilation and or acculturation or questioning that came about in the aftermath of the French Revolution.
And let me say one more thing. Maimonides' principles are tied in with this system, that this natural world to come, and therefore the followers of Maimonides state, in Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's famous term, Nebuch an Apikoros is still an Apikoros. You don't know any better, you're still an Apikoros. And that became a huge debate. However, the same people often urging acceptance of the Rambam's principles and calling people heretics if they don't accept any of them, they really don't follow this consistently. According to the Rambam's understanding, his philosophical understanding, no matter why you reject the principles, you're out of the fold. As Reb Chaim said, Nebuch an Apikoros. And yet, if you go into these circles, who are very much into Kirov, and if you see that they believe in a notion of Tinuk Shenishba, they try to tell their potential Balei Tshuva that your parents don't know any better, so they too will be saved. You wouldn't get many Balei Tshuva if you said to them, well, your parents, they're not going to the world to come because Nebuch, that's an unpalatable form of Judaism, so we understand why it's not advocated. But that's not Maimonidean. You can't, on the one hand, preach the principles and reject the substratum. Or for, I gave the example, a two-year-old child dies. The rabbi wants to be able to say the child is of God or something, but for the Rambam, that's not true. So these are tied into the Rambam's principles. And let me tell you briefly a story to show you that even in the 20th century, amongst extreme right-wing Rav Aravah, the Torah Sar and Hasidim, the Rambam's principles, despite all the rhetoric, are simply not accepted. He tells a story which is first told by Rav Moshe Chagiz, and it's repeated, and he expresses his disapproval of it. This Portuguese Jew leaves Portugal and goes to Safed, where he reverts to Judaism. He's a simple Jew. Every Friday, he brings bread to the synagogue, and he leaves it in front of the ark for God to eat. perhaps thinking back to the Eucharist, whatever it is, and every Friday the Shamus takes the bread home. Why not? One Friday, he's there leaving the bread, and the Rav is in the shul, and the Rav looks at him and says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "He's leaving bread to, for God to eat." And the Rav starts screaming at him, "You're not a heretic, where do you get this?" Later, the Ari heard about this, and he came in a dream to this rabbi and said, "Since the destruction of the Second Temple, I have had no greater pleasure in my existence, if you can use that term about God, than this poor man bringing his bread every Friday to the shul. And because you've destroyed that, you shall not live out the year." And so it happened that this rabbi died. This is the sort of story that you think back to the famous Levi Yitzchak Radicha of everyone's davening, and God only hears the boy who's whistling. And Rabbi Arava quotes this, and this, what is this? This is a rejection of the Rambam's notion that if you don't know any better, or if you think one thing, and yet you're in violation of the principle, you're a heretic. Rabbi Arava is following the tradition. It begins with the Raiva, it goes through Rav Yosef Albo, you see it in the Radbaz, down to Rav Kook, and to Rabbi Arava, of the most right wing, saying that God is not so concerned about the thoughts. If you don't know any better, it's your actions. So what more clear a rejection of a basic principle of the Rambam, the corporeal reality of God, than the story of Rav Arava?
So I just want to clarify, because there's something here that's a little confusing to me. I'm trying to weed out from what both of you are saying whether the Rambam, in fact, did believe what he wrote originally and changed it, or didn't believe it originally but spoke rhetorically slash politically. Because, Professor Kellner, you talked about that the question he's answering here is, who is a Jew? So, to which I would ask, so are you saying to me that if you don't accept the 13 principles, you fall outside of the boundaries of Maimonides' definition of a Jew? So, and he really believed that when he was writing it, or he did not believe it? He did. So, are we saying that when he wrote it, he believed it, and he believed it his whole life? Or when he wrote it, he believed it, and as Professor Shapiro was suggesting, he changed his mind later? So you don't agree with Professor Shapiro?
No, I disagree. It's rare that we disagree about these kinds of things. I disagree with it is very tiny. I think Rambam held on to the principles throughout his life. But we agree that throughout his life, they were a political text and not only a strictly religious text. I think he proposed them at the very beginning as a political text. And as I understand them, the only principles which are true dogmas, i.e. principles which you must hold in order to achieve a share in the world to come, are the first five, which summarize what we can call the basic teachings of Western philosophy to his day about the nature of God. And I believe that for Rambam, someone who makes a mistake on these principles simply does not earn that share in the world to come, because that person, to actualize your intellect, to adopt the language of the time, you have to know truths about important things. And there is nothing more important than to know truth about God. So I believe that for Rambam, someone who made a mistake about the first five had no share in the world to come. Someone who got the first five right but didn't know or made mistakes about the last, 13 minus 5? 8, thank you very much. May not have been a good member of the Jewish community, but certainly did not imperil their share in the world to come. I further believe, and here I'm really totally stepping outside the tradition, that for Rambam, the term Israelite has nothing to do with what we call Jews. It has to do with someone who knows the truth. And therefore, you can be, in effect, a member of Klal Yisrael, if you've never heard of the Jews, were born in India. Because what counts, Israelite is a term we use for someone who has a share in the world to come. Shares in the world to come are not apportioned according to your birth registry. Let me just develop this one more minute. The text you read from the Rambam, the conclusion of the 13 principles, the upshot of that text is that if a person violates every single possible law but maintains the principles correctly, they have a share in the world to come. I.e., it's Yom Kippur. You're eating a cheeseburger, simultaneously shooting your mother-in-law, but your theology is correct, you have a share in the world to come. And I have a very nice mother-in-law, it's just a joke. Rambam is here making a total break between practice and belief. He's turning Judaism from a religion based upon an ethnicity, expressed in behavior, into what can only be called a church of true believers.
But his church is not Halila Christian, it's Aristotelian, it's philosophical, it's truth-driven. So if I'm right about all this, then we have here a very different understanding of what's going on, and that's why I think that so much of what he's doing here is political in the good sense of the term. He's trying to help the Jews. But in order to really help them, he has to make them philosophical. In order to make them philosophical, he has to at least remove from them the grosser errors about God, and then they can perhaps move on.
So let me ask you, I mean, if he's removing it from ethnicity, so let's say you're a Gentile.
Right.
Right, and you believe in the 13 principles.
In the first five.
In the first five, or even all 13.
Yeah.
So let's say you say, so clearly you get Chelek Olam Haba. Do you get a Jew's Chelek Olam Haba?
I don't think there is such a thing as a Jew's Chelek.
There is no divisions in Maimonidean thought about, Jewish versus non-Jewish Olam Haba.
Look, Rambam was very proud to be a Jew. Rambam loved the Jewish people. Rambam thought that Jews who kept the Torah were tremendously at an advantage over Gentiles who didn't keep the Torah. But he had to have held that a Gentile who was a decent, moral human being, who approached God in the proper way, was superior to a paganized Jew or an immoral Jew. Judaism is a series of challenges for Rambam, not a series of endowments. God gives you no presents. God gives you challenges. You meet those challenges, you've done what you're supposed to do. You don't meet those challenges, the fact that your grandfather was a great rabbi of Eastern Europe cuts no ice.
I don't know how Professor Kellner could say that about the fourth principle, which in addition to speaking of God's ontological priority, also includes in that God's ability to create ex nihilo, denial of which is a denial. If you deny some of God's omnipotence, you deny all of God's omnipotence. And yet in the Guide for the Perplexed, he explicitly states that that this is not a dogma. So I have to take issue with you on that. I'll also point out
I'll respond to that in a minute.
I'll also point out that, and this gets back to what Elliot asked, according to the Mishnah Torah, you can believe all sorts of heretical things and you are still part of the community. The Mishnah Torah never says... if you think these or believe it, says Ha'omer, Ha'omer, Ha'omer. If you publicly state in a manner of destroying the Jewish community, you publicly state that the Torah is not from heaven, this and that, that's very different. We can have skeptics in our community. We can have people. That's not the same thing as people who are trying. This is nothing about Olam Haba. That's a different issue. Well, that's not in a community. We're not concerned about someone's individual thoughts. We're concerned if they live a Jewish life in a public way.
May I respond? Thank you. Briefly about the first issue, I'm going to tell you one of the most embarrassing stories of my life. I'm zipping along reading the Karim in Rabbi Kaffa's Hebrew translation of the Arabic text, and I suddenly see that the Rambam mentions in the fourth principle that God created the world ex nihilo, as I discussed in the Guide of the Perplexed. I say, wait a second, this text was written 30 years before the Guide of the Perplexed. So without doing anything further, I zip off a letter to Rav Kafetzal, Rehov Lutz, Demesay, and Yerushalayim, and say, what's going on? And he writes back a letter, a little piece of paper taken from Bank Kapolim, Bank Discount, and he says, Professor Nechbad, Yo'il betuvo lirot et taherat ha-shulayim. Maybe you look at the footnotes. So I go to the footnotes, and there Rav Kafech points out that in the original text of the 13 principles, there's no mention of creation. There is mention of ontic priority, philosophical notion that God is the cause of the universe without necessarily being its creator. In the Rambam's own copy of the Mishnah Torah, which we have, of the Perush Mishnayot, which we have on Nezikin, the section where Sanhedrin is found, in his own copy, there is an addendum in the margin where he says, creation ex nihilo. And now I think that what he's doing there is adding a political text. In other words, he had run into problems over this during the 30 years between the time he originally wrote it and the time he added that. You can buy the facsimile. You can see his writings in the margin. It's really quite amazing. So I'm not troubled by this fact. And what was the second thing I wanted to say?
No, but you're acknowledging that even the first five principles do not represent absolute dogmatic truth for Maimonides.
I'm acknowledging that, I happily admit to you that the way in which they're formulated has a political aspect. But they still represent, to quote Rav Willig, the first four and a half principles. Okay, I'm willing to give you that. There was something else I wanted to say, but I don't remember what it is. So
I just want to follow up.
Denial.
Can I say, that's really very important, especially because I prepared the text for you. Thank you very much, Mark.
So Rambam, take a look at the second text that was handed out.
On the second page, the second side.
On the flip side.
On the flip side, right, of the second text. Down towards the bottom, I write, a questioner had pointed out an apparent inconsistency in the in the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. Do you have that? In Laws of Idolatry 2.5, Rambam had stated that, known certain terms, that Jewish sectarians, Minim, are not considered as Jews in any fashion. They are never accepted as penitents. In Laws of Repentance 3.14, on the other hand, Rambam maintained that sectarians and heretics are excluded from the world to come only if they die unrepentant. But if repents is evil and is a penitent about truth, he is assured the world to come, since nothing stands in the way of repentance. That's the question. You're contradicting yourself. Here's his answer. What you consider to be a contradiction concerning sectarians, there is no contradiction whatsoever. One of the texts states they are never accepted as penitents, i.e., we do not accept their repentance and do not see them as falling under the category of penitents, but rather continue to see them as sectarian, as the sectarians they were, and assume that the righteousness of their behavior is motivated by fear or a desire to fool people. But the second text states that if they truthfully repented in all that concerns their relationship with their Creator, i.e., they organize their philosophy right, they have a share in the world to come. The second law concerns their relationship with their Creator, while the first concerns their relationship with other human beings, i.e., Rambam is distinguishing between who gets into heaven from who is accepted in the Jewish community. To be accepted in the Jewish community, you have to accept all 13 principles. Whom God lets into heaven is a separate issue, and that's, so to speak, God's problem.
It sounds like, from what you were saying, that this business of being accepted by the Jewish community would only be dealing in very rare cases, like a Spinoza, basically, who publicly announces rejection of the principles. But you're arguing that essentially the rhetoric that Maimonides gives here is almost meaningless, because you could harbor doubts about all 13 internally, and it would make no difference
and
at all.
And we don't have inquisitions, and we don't try to put people on the stake and find out what they believe. If you live as a Jew, and you're not disturbing the Jewish community, we've always welcomed everyone into the synagogues, and plenty of people, including, I have no doubt, great sages, have harbored doubts about all sorts of things. But at the end of the day, and I'm going to speak about this afternoon, about how the church responded to Mother Teresa's letters, because I think it's relevant, and I talk about how it's dully, but it's the same thing. It's the actions. It's the way they live their lives. The Jewish community was never interested. If you publicly came out and preached heresy, and especially tried to get people to follow you, it's no different than the Zakin Mamre. The Zakin Mamre is a great sage, but he tries to get people to violate the standard halakha. That's a problem for the community. If some individual has a belief, he can still be a member in good standing. That doesn't mean necessarily he's going to Olam Haba, but he's a member of our community.
So the way you're reading the principles, just to be
Mechal Shabbos. Mechal Shabbos. You could be a Mechal Shabbos, and yet you could be counted in a minion, and be a witness and everything. What is it? It's Mechal Shabbos for Hesia. You have to do it publicly. That's very important in our tradition.
So you're arguing that essentially from the beginning, the principles were not only a moot point, they were unenforceable. There wasn't an allegiance test. You wouldn't get stopped and asked, you know, do you believe in the 13? It's only if somebody comes out and explicitly denies them that there would be a problem. Of course, that's not really his language, right? His language is that you've got to affirm, as opposed to somebody coming out and saying, I don't affirm, which really takes us back to the Mishnah, in a sense.
Yeah, he does say that, but that's not the language in the Mishnah Torah. And even with this language, there never was a catechism. No one was ever called before a court or anything and told to affirm. The closest we get is with a convert. But that makes sense, because a convert's being brought in to our community. And even with the convert, he never says 13 principles, so you'd expect them. He says the basic principles of Judaism. There never has been a situation where we quiz people and get into it, because just like with sins, we don't quiz them about their personal sins. If they're sinning publicly, how many rabbis have talked about the homosexuality issue and made the distinction of chiluk? If you're marching in the front rows of Jews for homosexuality, that's very different than if you have an issue and, you know, it's a private thing. You know, we welcome everyone into our shuls, and whether, you know, personal beliefs is not the defining issue.
So somebody like, let's say, the Rabban's famous comment, right, in the Choshuvah, where Rambam says that you're a heretic if you believe that God is a body, and the Rabban's famous gloss on this is that greater than you have believed that God is a body, and they know this from their reading of Scripture in Agadah. So that person, that greater than you person, for Maimonides, heaven, in or out?
For Maimonides, obviously out.
Out.
Sure.
Because he stated it publicly, this person?
No.
Because he believed it.
Yeah,
no, so that's a contradiction to what you said before.
No.
This person believed
it. No, when he said it publicly, he had it privately.
Right, that's what I meant.
And I knew it, but he never said it privately. He's still a member of the community. Still a member of Shul. He doesn't have heaven. If he says it publicly,
so that's,
then we can't have him with us.
So basically,
same thing with the Chabad issue.
Okay.
Whether it's a heresy or not, we obviously can't have people going around preaching the Rebbe's the Messiah publicly, teaching in our schools and all that, but if they believe it privately, many well-known rabbis, right-wing rabbis, believe it's a private belief. We don't need to put them up as some well-known friend of mine, professor, thinks before a panel, a tribunal, and actually ask them, do you believe this? My kids went to Chabad camp. I have no idea what the counselors believe, but I do know they came home, they learned about Shabbos and Kashrus, but never came home speaking about the Rebbe. So, I mean, we do have these distinctions all the time in our lives.
Well, since it seems like all roads lead to Chabad, we'll ask a question about Chabad.
Only Flamingo Road.
I'm specifically thinking about a situation that occurred recently in Israel where a Beit Din refused to accept a non-Jew for conversion because the person affirmed a belief that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was the Messiah. This came up fairly recently. I think this is interesting when you think about Maimonides' own injection of theology into the conversion process. Many of you know that in the original Sugya and Nevamot, when the Gemara talks about conversion, it really doesn't say anything about theology. You're not asked whether you believe in God. You're not asked to talk about negation of idolatry. The Rambam, famously, when he codifies the Gemara, basically injects certain theological content to the proceeding, says that you teach the prospective convert about belief in God, God's unity, and the prohibition against idolatry. Based on that, I'm wondering how much you think, for the Rambam, belief issues should play a role in conversions. In other words, do you think for Maimonides, failure to believe in one of the principles or the situation that we alluded to in Israel would be a kind of deal breaker?
Perhaps. I don't know what the Batei Din do today in terms of all detail. Again, if someone's going to convert and they say, but I'm going to say Machnisei Rachamim, they're not going to be rejected. Or if they say that I sort of feel that the end of the Chumash, Rashi, where he quotes the belief that the last eight verses, which is found in the Gemara, were written by Joshua in direct contradiction to the Rambam's principle, I don't think these things are deal breakers. I think they, in a more general sense. But it's a difference between joining the club and being a member of the club. It's a privilege to join the Jewish people, and we can have higher standards. If you're not a Shomer Shabbos, you're a Jew in good standing, and we welcome you and all that, but we don't want to convert people who are not Shomer Shabbos. There are different standards between my brothers, who are already in the family, and the guys my sisters want to marry. You know what I mean? That's just the way it is.
Certainly for Rambam, it's a deal breaker. Flip out the flip side again of that page. Eliot mentioned the Brayta Yevamot Mem Zayin. Rambam in the Mishnah Torah very often will simply take a Talmudic text, translate it into Hebrew, and spin it. Put it the way in which he thinks it ought to be put. So here is his version of the text from the Gemara. The stuff that he added is in square brackets. Our rabbis taught, Tanu Rabbanan, if at the present time a man desires to become a proselyte, he is to be addressed as follows. Are you nuts? What reason do you have for desiring to become a proselyte? Do you not know that Israel at the present time are persecuted and oppressed, despised, harassed, and overcome by afflictions? If he replies, I know and yet I'm unworthy, he is accepted forthwith. Thus far, the text from the Gemara. Now the Rambam adds on his own authority the following sentence. He should then be made acquainted with the principles of the faith, which are the oneness of God and the prohibition of idolatry. These matters should be discussed in great detail. And given instruction, that's the Gemara again, and now Rambam again, though not at great length, in some of the minor and some of the major commandments. He is also told of the punishment for the transgression of the commandments, and as he is informed of the punishment for the transgression of the commandments, so he is informed for the reward granted for their fulfillment. So here we see Rambam taking a Talmudic text which is all about accepting all mitzvot, the yoke of the commandments, and injecting into it theological matters. Whether it's the 13 principles or their upshot, that's a separate issue, but that's what he's doing. And he presents it as a deal breaker.
Well, he doesn't say the 13.
No, he doesn't. That's a separate issue. But he certainly presents the theological orthodoxy.
Sure.
Look, for Chazal, if a person wanted to convert, following the model of Ruth,
Amech ami Elohayach Elohai. First she says, your nation is my nation, then your God is my God. So the Gemara follows that. Don't you know that you want to join the Jewish people and it's tough? And then they teach him about some mitzvot, right? Rambam is interested in having a person join who knows the theology and totally rearranges the text in that way.
So before I'm... Yeah, go ahead. She's raising her hand up. Yeah. We're going to have a question for you in a second. Before I ask more questions, since I don't run into this again, how many people here have questions? Okay, so sufficient that I can close early and let you ask your questions. Okay, so I'm going to then just summarize and open it to the floor. So we've done the great shrinking act here, it sounds to me. We've taken 15, we've shrunk them down to 5, and we've said you have to do it publicly, and that's when you'll lose your Olam Haba.
We didn't say that. We said you have to do it publicly in order to be thrown out of your local Orthodox shul. Losing your Olam Haba is between you and God. It's a private thing, and it doesn't matter if it's publicly or not.
Does the Rambam believe that if you hold this up, so if you're going to make that split, if you don't believe in one of the 13, public or private, forget about the community. Do you lose your Olam Haba?
It's hard to see how in the Rambam system you would lose your Olam Haba if you thought that the Messiah is descended from another of David's sons other than Solomon.
So you're saying that's the first five, then?
No, I mean, it seems the first five deal with theological truth, perhaps maybe some of the seventh and the eighth about prophecy, but certainly the first five. Others, they're heresy in one sense, in that you're kept out of the community. It's hard to see the system, the natural system, whereby if you... deny the coming of the Messiah, that has anything to do with the world to come. But yet, if you do it publicly, you're denying a basic Jewish belief, and you're not part of our community. But I think, although the Rambam doesn't say it, he would agree with the Raivad in issues like that. If that's what you believe, and you're a good person, it's not a deal breaker. Remember, it's a natural process. And what does the belief in the Messiah have to do with connecting your intellect to the divine intelligibles?
Okay. Before I open up the floor to questions, please give them a big hand.
Incidentally, before we get to the question, this is not my own thing. We have Rishonim and Achronim who actually say the same thing, that some of the Rambam's principles, other than the first five, have a political purpose, Lamigdar Milta, things of that nature.
While we're waiting, Mark sent me a text a couple of years ago in which one of the important Rishonim, Rishaya Detrani the Elder, basically says if these were serious issues, the Gemara would have made a bigger deal about them.
My question for Professor Kellner, what you said about being an Israelite is anybody who believes these things. 8 and 9 is about about Torah given from heaven. If all is required to be an Israelite is to believe this stuff, what importance is there in the Torah? We could just believe this stuff without the Torah. Torah has all types of commandments and talks about a family, Abrahamic family.
Yeah. Who's next? Anybody else? Go ahead. Step to the right.
I'm very grateful to Dr. Malamat for raising the last question you raised about how the 13 principles have been transformed in the forum of the Beit Din for determining who should be initiated into Jewish people. And I want to recount one abuse of the 13 principles where a woman was rejected on the basis of the dating of the creation of the world. She had studied archaeology and they were suspicious and asked her when the world was created. And she gave a scientific answer and was then declared pasul, not legitimate for conversion. And I think, I guess the danger of the Maimonidean approach to the 13 principles is their abuse in the hands of the powers that be. That in a way the Beit Din has been transformed into a kind of the Catholic system of determining social. The question that I want to ask is, how does one guard against that kind of litmus testing as who is a Jew on the basis of their belief system when you have a variety of beliefs?
Are there any other questions? Steps and Mike, please.
I'm a little bit confused how the Torah and the science fits together in Maimonides' views. For instance, Rabbi Kellner mentioned there's two books. So what would Maimonides think of the Midrash, God looked into the Torah and created the world? And also, how does particular Jewish history and destiny fit into the whole ideal goal of integrating these abstract principles in order to enter Olam Haba? And wouldn't a non-Jew, in a way, even though they're eligible in Maimonides' universal view, wouldn't they be at a distinct disadvantage? And why didn't, and does Maimonides believe that Torah doesn't fully explain the abstract principles and ideals? And if so, why does Maimonides think that God wouldn't have put them in the Torah if they're so important?
Yeah. We have a few hours for that.
Now we're in trouble.
Judaism is supposed to have special regard for the Ger Yatom, the Almana, and it seems to me that you're asking for the Ger, when you ask them to affirm the Ikarei Emunah, you're asking for them to make this Farhesia announcement of acknowledgement of the Yud Gimel Ikarim, and I think that that's not right.
Okay, let's begin with you. If all you need is...
I must apologize, I came late, so I'm not sure if this was referenced, but it's you mentioned Rishonim and Achronim. It's well known that the Chazon Ish...
You did talk about it?
But for all intents and purposes, I think it, lacking other Gedolim of our generation who have dealt with this, I think his commentary on the concept of Apikoros that the Rambam enunciates, that anybody who doesn't keep either the 5 or the 13 Ikarim is de facto an Apikoros, and as you quoted Rab Chaim saying Nebuch Apikoros, but the official position of the Chazon Ish, which he reiterates in several different places, is that in order to be defined an Apikoros, somebody has to do Tochacha. It depends on the mitzvah of Hocheach Tichiyach Et Amitecha. And because we are deficient, all of Klal Yisrael Bizman Hazeh are deficient in that, so therefore, de facto, nobody can be defined an Apikoros.
Thank you. There's no question.
It's a question in the sense that everything that you've said is all very relevant within the confines of the Rambam. It seems that the Chazon Ish, who also learned the Rambam very carefully, has taken the liberty of redefining his principle in a way which my understanding of how you interpreted the Rambam was not the way he wanted to make it in practice for the year 2008 or whenever he lived.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, let's begin. We'll do it one in order. If all you need is belief, what need is there of Torah? As if belief gets you to heaven, my Torah.
It's not so simple. Now, the bottom line is that, as I understand him correctly, Rambam really is a universalist. He really does believe that human beings are born more or less the same. He really does not think that Jews are born with any advantage over Gentiles. He really does, as our friend Daniel Esker likes to say, believe that Jews are distinguished from Gentiles by software and not by hardware. But the software is important. Now, in principle, the Gentile who runs a program which is similar to Torah is fine. a Jew who runs a program which is dissimilar from Torah is not fine. And again, what counts is the truth. It doesn't know not who said it, how they said it, in what language, in what accent, in whether it's Galician or Yiddish or Polish Yiddish, it doesn't matter. So that there is no, unlike the entire long tradition of Jewish particularism from Yehuda Levi through the Ramban, through the Kabbalah, through Hasidut, there is no upfront advantage given to a Jew. Well, that's the truth, right? I've always felt that it doesn't matter how many people hold an opinion, it depends who they are. So most Jews disagree with the Rambam, but he has in his camp God and Yeshayahu HaNavi. I think that's pretty good. Is that okay for an answer to that one?
I wouldn't know who asked it. How do we guard? I don't know if we can. The question that was asked second is a question that I was sort of raising in a way. How do you guard against this litmus test against a belief? Why is it such a big issue?
Well, the issue that you raise, that's not even in the principles. That's right. Maybe the 14th or the 15th or the 16th. Right. There's many more principles of faith that have been added on. Okay, so the problem is because you have government-controlled Batei Din. If all you had were private Batei Din and you had a separation of religion and state, it wouldn't matter. This Beit Din doesn't accept, so another Beit Din accepts. But the problem is only when people can't go on Aliyah because the government of Israel won't accept them. My answer would be that government religion should not be involved with the government that way. But it's never been a problem throughout Jewish history because every community has the right to determine what type of people they want to allow in. So in this community, they don't think that you'd be a good fit, so they don't want to convert you. But another community, you could find, and the children will marry. That's never been a problem. It's only when government, you have secular governments now determining who's a Jew based upon what Batei Din are deciding. So it's a political problem. It has nothing to do with our religious tradition, which would work fine even with Batei Din. You go to the RCA based in, they'll convert anyone. That's not a problem. Who believes that the world is, if you're Shomer Shabbos and you believe in Torah, you can believe the world's a billion years old. That's not going to be a deal breaker for the RCA based in.
Until recently.
No, it's still not a deal breaker for the RCA based in. The point is that the Rabbanut does not accept the RCA based in. That's the problem.
Let's move on to the next question, which is the well-known Zohar, right? Staka Baraita Bar Alma, right? God looked into the Torah, created the world, which seems to be wreaking havoc on our principles. How would Maimonides respond to that? And we'll just add the second one. How does Jewish history fit into the whole belief structure?
Okay, very good. With respect to the first, we all know that Medrash because Rashi cites it at the beginning of his commentary on the Torah. Rambam simply never mentions it. And there are many Midrashim. Some people quote, some people don't quote. This became a very important Medrash because Rashi quoted it in the first verses of the Bible. So even if you stop going to Hebrew school on the second day, you'll learn that on the first day. Quite simply, Rambam did not agree with the Medrash. For Rambam, the Torah does not pre-exist creation. And how do I know that? Because the Rambam teaches us that there are commandments in the Torah which are responses to historically conditioned events, like the gentleman asked about sacrifices. Or the long list of chukim, which Rambam says were instituted because of specific customs of idolatry. Why are Jews forbidden to wear shatnez, linen and wool together? Because idolatrous priests, he says, wore linen and wool together. If idolatrous priests in the days of Avraham Avinu, Abraham, wore polyester, then Jews would be forbidden to wear polyester. That's the Rambam's position. So for him, Torah is a text which in principle could have been different. It isn't different, but it could have been different. And that's a dramatically different understanding than the more standard Kabbalistic view. The view of the Ramban, for example, that the Torah is the names of God. The view that the Torah pre-exists creation, in effect, the Torah is the blueprint of the universe. That's simply not Maimonides' view.
I just want to jump in because I think you could make your point even stronger. In his book, you say at the beginning of that book that if, I think it was the Navajo Indians,
yeah.
Right, that if the...
I'm convinced that the way Rambam presents the story in the Laws of Idolatry, I read it as follows. During the time of the biblical figure Enosh, human beings fell into idolatry, lost their connection to God. Abraham was the first person
to discover God again through his own unaided reason. There's an interesting machloket there. Most Jews say that Avraham discovered God at age 3. Rambam prefers the minority midrashic view that Avraham was aged 40, because he wants to emphasize it was a matter of learning and work, and he didn't get to it through some miraculous fashion at age 3. He became a good philosopher. He seems to be saying that it's a coincidence, an historical accident, that Abraham was the first person to discover, to choose God, so to speak, and in consequence, God chose Abraham's descendants. If the first person after the fall into idolatry had been a Navajo Indian, then the Torah would have been given in the Navajo language. It would reflect the history of the Navajo people, and its commandments would reflect the reality of life in Nevada or whatever. So that doesn't mean the Torah is not divine. It doesn't mean that the Torah is not true. It doesn't mean that the Torah doesn't give commandments which have to be obeyed. It just says that his view of Torah is different from that held by other versions of Judaism.
So the Torah's language, as it's written here, is really an historical accident.
Yeah.
Okay.
I said yes, if it's a mavikach, you know. I mean, most people should be for saying that.
We don't have time to shoot you because we have to move to the next session. Torah doesn't fully explain abstract principles, according to the Rambam. Oh, it's not written as a philosophical text.
Right.
So why not?
Okay, and that gets back to the other question that was asked about the nature of the Jewish people and their history. The two are connected. As I understand Rambam, God's plan is for human beings to achieve, in the Messianic era, a universal connection to God. And that's hard to do. There's a machloket between the students, a controversy in one of the midrashim between the students of Rabbi Yishmael and the students of Rabbi Akiva. The students of Rabbi Akiva say Torah nitna li Israel. The Torah was given to Israel. The students of Rabbi Yishmael say Torah nitna l'chol ba'olam. The Torah was given for all human beings. But in the interim, it was given to Israel because all human beings aren't ready to accept it. So I see the role of the Jewish people is, you know, the famous story that the Reform adopted the so-called mission theory of Judaism. It was the mission of the Jews to spread. So one Orthodox rabbi said, "Oh, I understand that mission, milk and meat." Well, sir, never mind. Anyway, that was a very unsuccessful joke. Yeah. Rambam's view of the Jewish people is a group whose job it is to preserve the Torah for all humanity. It'll take a long time, but that means the Jews have a very important role. But he also, in a text censored out of his Laws of Kings at the end, where he talks about the Messiah, he also gives a messianic role to the Christians and the Muslims, saying that they have to, so to speak, monotheize the world in order to make it possible for all human beings to accept God. So that's the way I see this connection. Oh, and that's why there's no philosophy in the Torah, because the Torah is aimed at everybody, all Jews, and most Jews can't really handle the philosophy.
So we're going to finish up with Dr. Shapiro. I'm still on his wife's question, which was, I'm not sure.
About
why are we unfair to Ger?
It says to treat the Ger properly, which incidentally, in the context, I'm not referring to a convert. It's referring to the stranger. But certainly we need to treat all people with kindness and be friendly with them. But that doesn't mean that everyone who wants to convert is permitted to convert. I don't think this is a mistreatment of a non-Jew if in examination we determine that this person will not be a good fit in our group any more than if you're dating someone and you're a very nice person, but you feel this is not going to be a good match in my family, we're not going to, or in a club or anything of that nature. If you know anything about the Syrian community, you see how this could somehow reach extremes where you do get to this point where it's almost like a Jewish racism. But leaving that aside, I don't see why not permitting anyone to enter our club. After all, we have to have standards. Any club, you know, it's like Groucho Marx said, I want to be a member of a club, any club that allow me in. I mean, but it speaks to the idea that you need to have standards. And I'm not saying where the standards to be, but the notion that everyone has the right, that non-Jews have the right. I'm in a Catholic university. They have standards, and you can't just come and decide you want to be a Catholic. So obviously we have to be fair and friendly. and not put too high barriers because people who want to become Jewish should be allowed to become Jewish. But that doesn't mean that they have a right. It's a privilege. And about the Chazon Ish, it's a good point. Actually, the Chazon Ish is not saying anything new. Well, the Rambam himself, in the Mishnah Torah itself, describes the children of the Karaites who don't know any better, and they are not to be treated as heretics. They're to be treated, as friendly, and we can bring them into the community. And the Chazon Ish is applying that to everyone today. Everyone today has the status of a Tinuk Shenishva. However, if the Chazon Ish is saying that these people, in addition, also have a share in the world to come, it's not clear that he's saying that, then he is not adopting the Rambam's view, he is adopting the Raiva's view, and if he thinks he's adopting the Rambam's view, and he then all I can say is that he never learned the Guide for the Perplexed, and in this matter, there's no question that Reb Chaim and Reb Chanan Wasserman and a number of others understood the Rambam's philosophy better than the Chazon Ish, because according to the Rambam, although we do not judge people as heretics if they don't know any better, even today if they speak publicly, we still try to bring them in. After all the Kirov organizations are out with going after people who are public heretics, in which the Rambam says you shouldn't be involved with them. The Chazon Ish says, no, today is different. But at the end of the day, for the Rambam's philosophy, unlike the Raivad, and Reb Chaim recognized this, if they don't change, the fact that they don't know any better, it's not a punishment, but that's just the way of the world, the Nebuch. But that's the way of the world.
Thank you very much.
Hold on, what?